This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, the Supreme Court fans the flames of discrimination in New Haven firefighter ruling, and African-American firefighters battle hiring discrimination in Bloomberg's fire department.
Then, adding insult to injury, workers fight Wells Fargo to keep jobs and suffer arrests. But now, headlines from the front lines of labor with Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. GM is emerging as a new company with $50 billion in government money, having shed huge debts and liabilities in a 38-day fast-tracked bankruptcy. The federal government will own 60% of the new company, while the UAW-run Retiree Health Care Trust will own 17.5%. The union is paying a huge price to help GM renew itself, having given up tens of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in cash payments to the Retiree Health Care Trust, as well as future wage and benefits concessions. Rich Trumka is formally in the running to become the next AFL-CIO president. He is unopposed for that post. Trumka, a former president of the United Mine Workers of America, says he has great hope for the future based on a determination to reunify labor and to restore worker bargaining power. Trumka says he and his slate are committed to bringing new ideas and new energy to the helm of the AFL-CIO. Running with Trumka are Arlene Holt Baker as executive vice president and the IBEW's Liz Schuler as secretary treasurer. Trumka pledged a vigorous AFL-CIO that will be more transparent and more accountable to the needs of the affiliate unions. Businesses that are granted federal contracts will need to verify that workers have legal immigration status, as according to Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Businesses will need to use the government's E-Verify system. Homeland Security dropped a no-match rule that had required employers to fire workers who had mismatched Social Security information. Construction of stadiums in advance of South Africa hosting the World Cup has come to a halt as workers demand better wages. Jesse Russell reports.
In June 2010, South Africa will be hosting the World Cup, and in advance of those games, the country needs to build stadiums and rail stations. Roughly 70,000 workers involved in those projects have been on strike for 2 days, demanding a 13% pay increase. Employers are offering the workers 10.5%. The construction is currently scheduled to be completed by mid-December, but a prolonged labor confrontation could delay the project. It is the first time the African continent has won the opportunity to host the World Cup. To prepare, 5 stadiums are being built in South Africa, in addition to upgrades to 5 current stadiums. One 68,000-seat stadium is already behind schedule due to 2 previous strikes by construction workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News.
And you are tuned into WBAI, and I think one of the critical legal decisions that came down from the Supreme Court this term is something that we have to look at. When their written test for promotion in the fire department produced no successful African-American candidates, the city of New Haven nullified the results. White firefighters then brought a legal challenge against the city. The challenge was defeated by an appellate court that included Judge Sotomayor, now a nominee for appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court.
The New Haven case ultimately went to the U.S. Supreme Court, who overturned the appellate court. Justice Ginsburg, in a particularly pointed dissent to the majority ruling, gave historic background to the New Haven determination, reminding us that firefighting is a profession in which the legacy of racial discrimination casts an especially long shadow.
We're joined by Renika Moore, Associate Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and also Donald Day, past NE Regional Director Associate of the Professional Black Firefighters, and the Supreme Court fans the flames of discrimination in New Haven firefighting ruling. That, at least, is my opinion on the matter, but we'll find out from folks who were much more intimately involved. And I want to begin with Donald, and first of all, good evening.
Good evening.
Donald, tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience with the issue of firefighting relevant to New Haven, and what the circumstances and conditions of African-American firefighters were within the department.
Sure. I am a retired captain of Bridgeport, Connecticut Fire Department, which is about 12 miles outside of New Haven. At the time when this case first initiated, I was the director of the Northeast Region, so I had an opportunity to be involved with this case at its inception. The fire department has a long and illustrious history of discrimination, and equally long and illustrious stance at giving tests that are disparate. City of Bridgeport, we had to sue the City of Bridgeport on two occasions because we received tests that had disparate impacts on African-American, Latino, and the last time was probably 20 years ago. Since that time, our city made a concerted effort to give a test that measured all the qualities that it took to be a good officer, a good lieutenant, a good captain or battalion chief, and New Haven failed to do that. New Haven News, they gave more weight to the written exam, which was scored 60% of that exam, and most American fire departments have abandoned such tests or limited the multiple choice format to 30% or less of an applicant score. When New Haven used their multiple choice test to measure its firefighters' retention of information from national firefighting textbooks and guides, civil service tests like these do not identify people who are best suited for leadership positions. You know, we feel that the most important skills of any fire department lieutenant or captain are steady command presence, sound judgment, and ability to make life or death decisions under pressure. It's impossible for a written exam to measure those qualities. And that's where New Haven made its first mistake, was under the union's guidance, was to change the relative weights to 60% of the written and 40% for the oral, which gave an unfair advantage to those white candidates in a city that is 50% African-American Latino. Less than 18% of their leadership are African-Americans and Latinos.
Renika, perhaps you can educate us a little bit, or educate me. I think Mimi's got this down on the law here in terms of what the appellate ruling was and what the Supreme Court did.
Well, can we even go a little bit back? Because I think it's important to understand that the city actually had a determination. So before we get to the appellate ruling, why don't you tell us how
we got to that point?
Absolutely.
Let's
sure. That's the beginning.
Okay.
So after the city was after the test was administered, when the results came back and the city of New Haven saw that none of the African-American firefighters who had sat for the exam were going to be eligible for promotion, they were concerned, and they essentially said, let's take a moment, figure out what happened with this test, and make sure that this was the fairest test that we could administer. And what they put together was a civil service board to review the exam, and they brought in test examiners to look at what's called the content validity. I won't go into the specifics of kind of how they looked at the exam, but essentially what some of the test examiners who looked at the test that New Haven had administered, they saw that what Mr. Day pointed out in terms of the test didn't capture certain things like command presence and the kind of things that are just really important for a firefighter to be able to do in order to be in a supervisory position. And so looking at the test, there was this independent civil service board, and once they reviewed, they essentially said there are other tests out there that we should try this again, and that would open the doors to the African American and Latino firefighters in a way that this test didn't. And when they decided not to use that test, that's when the plaintiffs in this case, 12 plaintiffs, one Latino, the rest white, decided to file charges against the city of New Haven, essentially asserting that the city of New Haven had discriminated against them. And so at the district court essentially found that because the city of New Haven's decision to not use the test was in their attempt to avoid a potential lawsuit under Title VII, which is the statute that protects against discrimination, and that lawsuit says that you can't, an employer can't use a system that looks neutral or a process that looks neutral on its face that says, but in fact, once it's administered, it weeds out large portions of protected groups, and so in this case, African Americans and Latinos. And the court said that the city of New Haven was within the bounds of Title VII and that what they had done did not violate the rights of the plaintiffs under Title VII or under the Constitution, which also provides under the 14th Amendment for equal protection regardless of race. The plaintiffs then appealed to the Second Circuit. And when they appealed to the Second Circuit essentially adopted the reasoning of the district court. And the Second Circuit is the panel that Judge Sotomayor was on. And that court said that the district court had properly applied Title VII and that what the city of New Haven had done was in keeping with the law and what Congress really thought and what they intended for employers to do when they were faced with a situation where a test or a hiring process weeded out large numbers of African Americans or other minorities in a way that wasn't tied to the job itself. And that's really the history of Title, and even Title VII's expansion was initially only covered private employers, and when it was expanded to public employers, it was specifically because of firefighters, because there was such entrenched discrimination that they were seeing in fire departments. And that they weren't seeing the progress racially or in terms of gender in integration of fire departments.
Captain, I wonder if you think, is it the test itself, you said that it's not measuring certain characteristics that are really significantly important for somebody to be in a supervisory position. But do you feel the tests are neutral? Are they slanted? Or why can't Black and Latino firefighters similarly pass this as their white counterparts, if you will? I mean, how do we understand the problem with the testing procedure?
Well, the testing procedure, if you use tests that measures focuses on job challenges and focuses on problem solving in the relative context, African Americans and Latinos do as well, if not better than our white counterparts on those kind of exams. It's just the memorization part of the test, which really don't have any relevance in firefighting, that they score better than African Americans. Like when I made captain, I came out number two, 300ths of a point from number one. But one of the questions on my exam was, what is the chemical compound of plastic? Well, you know, being a firefighter for 26 and a half years, that has no relevance to me. What's important to me is if I have a fire, occupied structure, 2 o'clock in the morning, exposures on the B and then D side, how would I handle this fire? Well, being 2 o'clock in the morning is occupied structure. I know somebody's probably in that house. It's probably occupied. Somebody might be trapped in there. You got the exposures on the left and right side of this fire. I want to make sure that fire don't spread. And I want to tell my additional companies where they should be. These are the kind of tests, real-life experiences in the fire service that African-Americans and Latinos do extremely well on, and like I said, as well as our white counterparts. And any time you use the norm, the standard in firefighting is not to score the written exam, which is nothing but memorization, higher than 30%. Bridgeport, we use 65%, 60% for the oral or the assessment, 30% for the written, and 10% for seniority. And we don't have a problem getting an extremely diverse leadership in our department. And that's where New Haven dropped the ball. And let me just say one thing. This exam has never been validated. They've never done a validity study on this exam to find out if it was valid, if it was indeed valid. This was destined to fail right from the beginning when New Haven changed their testing company and hired IO Solutions. When they did that, we went to New Haven and told them that if you look at IO Solutions' website, they list 119 cities where they've administered tests for promotions. Out of these 119 cities, there wasn't one city in there that was the population of New Haven, nor was there one community in there that was had the diverse population of New Haven. This was a testing company that has administered tests for very small departments. And we told them right from the beginning that they lacked the capacity to put together a test that, one, would not have a disparate impact, and an exam that would be fair to not only African Americans and Latinos, but whites as well, and would, in turn, give your department the best candidates to be lieutenants and captains.
Sir Anika, when the Supreme Court overruled the decision, were they basically saying that the other court had made a mistake under existing law, or are they changing the interpretations of the law?
Right. They actually established a new standard that wasn't in place prior to June 29th when this decision was handed down. What the court essentially did is they imported a standard based on the constitutional standard that exists for the equal protection, which is a different law. It's a protection that wasn't conceived of in the conception of Title VII. And so the court basically said it's not enough for the city to have a good faith belief that they might have been sued and that there was a disparate impact based on the statistics which showed what Justice O'Connor called the inexorable zero, in that there were no African Americans who would have been up for promotion. The court said that wasn't enough, and that the fact that there was testimony of other test experts saying that this test hadn't been content validated, the court said that still wasn't enough. And they really showed an insensitivity to both the history and legacy of discrimination and to the facts that were present in this case in particular. So they did establish a new standard. And what we see in the dissent is the dissent really saying that you're ignoring a lot of the circumstances and the context of what's going on in New Haven, what the community looks like, what happened with this test. And I think this is consistent with this court. We've seen them moving away from a history or from precedent that was doing what it could to open the doors for previously excluded groups.
Renika, I was kidding with you before I went on the air. And I'm not going to do the chant as I might in a demonstration. Well, yes, I will. No, I won't. But I remember one of the many demonstrations I went to in Washington, D.C., and this one was really coordinated by the National Conference of Black Lawyers and various support groups, and that was when the first, quote-unquote, reverse discrimination lawsuit came into being, and that was the case of Alan Bakke. And the chant was kind of, we're going to beat, beat back, the Bakke attack. All right, I won't go any further with that. But ever since the Alan Bakke case, it would seem that the consent decrees that have been put in place, such as the New Haven one and so on, have begun to systematically be dismantled by legal challenge, not unlike the one of the white firefighters in New Haven. So is affirmative action, which essentially if I were to describe it, is a leveling to some degree, as much as you can level it, of the playing field based on the history and the reality, and I think the legacy that is still apparent of racism in this country. Is it really shot at this point? Has it really gone up in flames? Can we still hold on to some consideration of discrimination and use affirmative action as a some redress?
Right. Well, this case was unusual because, first, yes, I think there is still something to be salvaged. I think we've clearly lost ground, this decision made it harder for employers to proactively work to make to open their doors and to make their workplaces more diverse and to allow previously excluded groups in. But at the same time, what the court did was essentially say that an employer really has to show, the term they used was strong basis in evidence, but that they have to show clearly why they believe that they would be subject to a lawsuit based on the disparate impact standard, based on the fact that there's a practice that appears to be neutral on its face that's excluding people. And so there is still something, I think there is still a requirement that employers follow and that they really try to work to bring in more people. And if they see that there's a practice that's doing so, that's excluding people, that they work to make sure and root that out. But what I think this decision really does is requires employers to take steps before they administer the test. So in this situation, and in firefighting departments across the country, the idea is that you get the test right the first time. And so I think New Haven's position was made harder by the fact that they had this exam, that people knew the results, and so you had an identifiable group who felt like they were losing something, which, you know, LDF doesn't really necessarily think that the promotions were the entitlement of the plaintiffs at the point in which the test was thrown out, but I think they created problems for themselves by administering the test and then trying to get rid of the test once the results were known. So what this decision does is make it so that employers really have to try harder at the front end to really make sure that they're using a process that's fair and equal.
And Donald, we only have about a minute, but where do the New Haven firefighters go from here?
Well, the New Haven firefighters are waiting for the city to ultimately do what they're going to do, certify the list. And once the city certifies the list, it's my understanding that the New Haven firefighters are going to file a lawsuit to say the test was never validated, so we don't know if we have a valid exam or not, and move forward from that perspective. And let me just say that, you know, it was an awful decision what the Supreme Court did, but it's not as awful as it could have been. You know, what the court did was totally screwed up voluntary compliance, which was one of the main goals of Title VII. We're concerned in that if a city don't have to voluntarily comply with Title VII, then it'll go back to where it was when I first came on the job. They'll give the cheapest test possible because, you know, the economic climate of today isn't good. So cities will go back to doing the cheapest test possible, and it'll have monumental consequences on blacks that aspire for upward mobility in the fire department.
I'm just pausing for a moment because I think the consequences are so significant. I know that Council Renika Moore has put a good spin on it, and obviously we have to. We did that with so many of the prior cases that came down from the Supreme Court, unfortunately, when it came to affirmative action. But I guess at the same time, when we have people like Captain Day, we will continue to struggle. And whether it's getting it better or right the first time so it will be less subject to challenge, whether it's getting the educational system right the first time, so that becomes part of the process, or perhaps a better political sensitivity in our society as a whole as to its collective obligation to remedy the legacy and the apparent and real effects of racism within I would say every endeavor within our society has the remnants of these inequities, these disparities, these are very real aspects of historic discrimination. And you look like you want to give it a punctuation, Renika.
No, I just think that we are seeing a systematic attack across sectors. So whether it's education, we had a case before the court this season, the voting rights case, where we're seeing concerted effort to really draw back the civil rights protections that the Legal Defense Fund and lots of other organizations fought to get in place in the first place. And so in this case, in Ritchie, we're fighting for the standard that we pushed for in Griggs v. Duke back in the 70s, we're trying to get rid of these headwinds to the advancement and the advancement or even just the entrance of minorities into these community, into these occupations. And so we're also seeing that in voting rights with the Northwest Utility District, where we saw the Center for Individual Rights, which is an organization that is really mounting a concerted effort to peel back the civil rights protections. And so these certainly aren't anomalies. They're definitely looking for these cases. And I think that's an important thing to think about as we, as employers try to comply with these requirements, that there is an actual, you know, a concerted effort to really to do something about these civil rights protections and to really undermine them. And they've got a friendly court.
And I can't think about any better legal organization to continue the good fight other than the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund and one of its newer attorneys, Renika Moore, who is associate counsel in the and you're in the economic justice component of it, and Captain Donald Day, past Northeast Regional Director of the Association of Professional Black Firefighters. Thanks to both of you for helping us understand the significance of your efforts and your talents, as well as the importance of this particular Supreme Court ruling. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, and thank you for having us. This is a very important dialogue, and I appreciate your station for doing this.
Thank you. And we're actually going to continue the dialogue with the Vulcan Society. So thank you, and I'm sure we'll have you back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a nice day.
New York City Fire Department is only 2.9% African American. It's the least diverse fire department of any large U.S. city. In 2002, the U.S. government and the Vulcan Society, the fraternal organization of New York City Black Firefighters, filed a class action lawsuit against the City of New York's discriminatory hiring practices.
The central issue is whether the skills measured by the Fire Department of New York's written exam has any relationship to skills necessary to be a good firefighter, much like we just discussed in the New Haven case. Now, African American firefighters battle hiring discrimination in Bloomberg's Fire Department with John Combs, president of the Vulcan Society, and Paul Washington, past president of the Vulcan Society, and Darius Charney, attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. And good evening to all of you.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
John, 2.9% African American in New York City. I'm just flabbergasted. I mean, I keep on expecting 3.9% one day, 4.9%, it just stays there.
And that's correct. In my short time in the fire department, my 10, almost 11 years, it
Your
hasn't
short
moved.
Time, 10 or 11 years,
yeah,
okay.
It hasn't moved. It hasn't changed, and that's just a clear indication of how committed the FDNY and Mayor Bloomberg are to diversity in New York City.
I just want to find out how you got involved in the fire department. I know most of us in this room, not all of us, but most of us are from Brooklyn, That does hold special to me. How did you get involved in the fire department, and what were your expectations and understanding when you first entered the department, John?
Well, I was introduced to the fire service by none other than, I can say the name, Paul Green, Lieutenant Paul Green, and Al Washington, another past president of the Vulcan Society. I just saw two men walking down the street in fire department work duty uniforms, and I hadn't seen anyone that looked like me up until that point who was in the fire service. So there I was, all of, 24, and I met these two gentlemen, and I was giving them so much praise that they invited me to take the next exam, and here I am. My expectations, I really didn't have many. I was more excited than anything, but then the reality of the culture shock was real in the academy when I was one of eight of 300.
And, oh, my goodness.
And at the time, it was one woman, Regina Wilson. She had been the only woman entering, female entering the fire service at that point, something like 14 years. So here we are. I said, wow, it just never dawned on me how luster it was as it related to diversity in the fire department.
And President Washington, what about yourself?
Actually, I came on a very traditional way. My father was a firefighter, and my older brother and an uncle, so I had a lot of family on the job, and that's a big advantage in becoming a New York City firefighter. And I wouldn't say most, but a good percentage, probably about 30% or more of the New York City firefighters have family or close friends on the job, and that's an advantage that blacks, by and large, don't enjoy. Very few of us know about the job, how good it is, and so that's one big disadvantage that we have.
And Darius, why don't you give us a lawsuit 101 on the lawsuit between not only the CCR but also the U.S. government against the New York City fire department?
Sure. Well, back in 2002, it was actually the Vulcan Society, Paul and some other folks who brought this case to our attention, and then we, along with the Vulcans, filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that is in charge of enforcing Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And the EEOC did an investigation, which lasted, I think, more than a year. It was a very in-depth, thorough investigation. And they concluded, I think it was the end of 2005, that in fact, the city was violating Title VII of the Civil Rights Act with respect to the exam that it gave in 1999, and then they gave a similar exam in 2002, that both of those exams, there was probable cause to believe that they had violated Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. At that point, the EEOC attempted to negotiate with both Vulcans and the city. That did not work out too well, at which point they referred the case to the Department of Justice. And this is, keep in mind, the Bush Department of Justice, so not necessarily a very sympathetic Department of Justice when it comes to civil rights. However, that Justice Department decided that, in fact, because of the clear evidence of discrimination on the part of New York City, that they were going to, in fact, file a lawsuit against the City of New York, which they did in 2007, and the Vulcan Society, as the original complainants, were allowed to intervene in the lawsuit, and so we are now co-plaintiffs with the Department of Justice in this case.
Darius, I think Renika Moore, who's also in studio, we've just been discussing the New Haven case. You could have cribbed each other's briefs.
definitely.
And, you know, but aside from the humor of that, again, if there's any homogeneity, it's the homogeneity in reality of the level of discrimination that exists in big cities across the country. And President Combs, I want you to give us just some understanding of your view and your concern about the testing and promotional procedure that has engulfed you, really, and that's probably not the right word to use, given that you're firefighters, but that has enmeshed you, really, in this case that is being brought by the Vulcan Society.
Well, first and foremost, the Vulcan Society, prior to my administration, we've taken a position, and we still do, even there's no exam in itself that can weigh solely what an individual will be as it relates to a particular position. Just an exam. Scratching bubbles and my 14 years ago didn't make me a good firefighter. There was no indication there that would say John Coombs would be a heck of a firefighter. He would be a decent chauffeur. He would know how to do his task as a firefighter. So not only is it outdated, just to put so much weight into that without any validity, and FDNY does not validate their exams either. It's just exam after exam after exam. However poorly designed, they still continue. Now, unfortunately, the mechanism of testing, if it's flawed, then you can't possibly have the best. So just to examine that aspect of it, if you take a cold, hard look, then you would realize that there are better mechanisms out there. New York City needs to get on board with the rest of the world and realize there are better testing mechanisms that we can follow. Like, for example, Alabama. They at least have an assessment.
Alabama?
Alabama. Sorry, I was in Alabama. The South is more progressive than the North.
New York chauvinistic, but...
Well, it may be chauvinistic, but it happens to be reality. Hmm.
And why is it that, Renika, you were...
No, I was going to say that also in terms of the history of when these requirements came into place, for instance, in Cleveland, they didn't see the requirement that firefighters have high school diplomas until the fire department began to integrate, and they used it as a way to keep black firefighters out. Mm-hmm. And we saw testing implemented in other places at the same time that it was not a coincidence that we see these hurdles to admission once fire departments start to integrate. And so these, you know, you have to kind of look at the history of when these hurdles and obstacles to getting in first were implemented.
And Paul, I know that Commissioner Scarpetta has been saying, well, we've changed now. We have a new test in, was it 2 years ago, 2007? We've done active recruiting. Things have changed. Well, is change coming?
No, very, very, very slowly. First of all, whatever small changes they made, they were forced to make. And with the Justice Department, with this lawsuit hanging over their head, as well as the media attention that we brought to them, as well as the political pressure. We had every black politician in the city was calling the mayor and the commissioner and writing them and expressing interest in wanting to see more blacks on the job. Those are the things that made them change, what little change that they did actually do. And, I mean, this last list, the list that's out now that they're bragging about is maybe 33% people of color. That's in a city that's 66% people of color, and that 33% is coming on to a job that's 90% white. What type of impact is that going to have? Very little. I mean, it's a slight improvement, but it's nowhere near what it should be. The fire department should be looking at 70% of people of color coming on to this job, and they need to have those type of numbers year after year. Like President Coombs had mentioned as well, there's no mystery how to do this. The military's done an excellent job integrating its numbers, and they set a standard, a baseline of what you have to achieve on their various tests. If you can pass those tests, they know that you're trainable, and from there on they train you. And the military, we know, is always touted as being the greatest military in the world. And it's very well integrated, and it's not a mystery on how to do these things. The NYPD is much more integrated than the fire department. Every fire department in the country has figured this out, except New York. You know, why is the mayor and the commissioner dragging their feet on this? Why do they not want to show the commitment necessary to get this matter resolved?
Maybe we can take some of that $36 million or the $100 million that Bloomberg is expected to spend from his own cash on re-election and utilize that to begin to really have the kind of recruitment, et cetera, that is going to balance out the reality of who lives in the city and who's been kept out of these jobs. But so much for my comments on this, Darius. I still want to push the envelope a little bit. Somebody might be out there saying, now, wait a minute. People in firefighting, there's a whole kind of level of, maybe they do need to know about chemistry, maybe they need to know more about biology and other things in terms of life saving. So don't these tests in any way have any valid purpose that should be credentialized in our discussion?
Well, the main problem here is that, and I think Renika hit on it earlier, what a test has to do to be able to satisfy Title VII is it has to be validated. In other words, there has to be a systematic study to determine if the test, in fact, is testing the skills and knowledge that are necessary for the job that it's being used for. And in the case of New York City, I mean, I can't speak to, you know, New Haven or any of the other tests, but in the case of New York City, that has never been done. None of these tests that we are challenging, nor even the, you know, tests that came before that, were sufficiently validated to determine if, in fact, they were testing the skills necessary to be a firefighter. And unless and until that happens, the city of New York cannot, you know, say and justify these tests by saying, oh, these measure the skills necessary to be a firefighter. You know, and that would be our main response to this, that if in fact this is true, then they need to provide the data to show that these tests are related. And, you know, John will tell you, Paul will tell you, and probably any other firefighter you talk to, that, you know, what a firefighter got in terms of score on the written exam has nothing to do with how good of a firefighter they are. And I don't even think, you know, the guys on the job care or know what each other got on the test that they took
That's
to get
right.
into the fire department. So
right.
it's, you know, it, there really at this point is no evidence to show that the test that New York is using measures accurately somebody's ability to be a firefighter.
So, John, the lawsuit, the struggle continues?
Has to. We're talking about future generations being employed in our city. I mean, if we look at it from an economic standpoint, as the mayor would like to point out so adamantly and often, he literally allows millions of dollars to literally drive out of the city every pay period. And we have talent here, a city of almost 10 million people. You mean to tell me, exam after exam, there are very few who are interested in the well-being of their communities. There are very few who are interested in becoming firefighters, and there are very few who really want to be firefighters in New York. I doubt that very seriously. I would hope that the city of New York and residents in general look at what the mayor has done. He has ignored your request. He ignores you on every challenge. And let's send him home. Let's send him packing. His time is up.
President Washington, where do we go from here? How does the struggle continue? What do we need to understand about the efforts of the Vulcan Society and why indeed there has to be a Vulcan Society to push on these issues?
Yeah, well, we'll always need Vulcan societies and NAACPs and such organizations as long as there's racism in the country. And we know that there is now. We're nowhere near a so-called colorblind society. I don't know if we'll ever get there, but we're certainly not there yet. So we'll always need the efforts of organizations like this. And one other thing I'd like to point out, this lawsuit that we are bringing, if we're in the mode of trying to settle this lawsuit, we can settle this out of court. We've sat down with the city and told them the things that we think are necessary to cause a settlement. And if we do settle, this can save the city millions of dollars. Mayor Bloomberg is very good at spending his own money for re-election, and that's fine. But he's also willing to spend millions of the city's dollars to go forth with this lawsuit to get re-elected. He's not looking to settle this at this particular time because it could have political consequences for him in terms of hurting his re-election bid. And that's fine if you want to spend your own money, but he shouldn't be spending millions of the city's dollars trying to fight this lawsuit that he knows when it does come to court, the city's going to lose.
And we're going to give you the last word, Darius. What's the procedural posture of the suit?
So at this point, there is actually a motion that we, the Vulcan Society, and also the government filed for summary judgment, in other words, to We filed a motion that argues that we should win the case without even having to have a trial because the facts that are not in dispute in the case in and of themselves establish that, you know, there was a Title VII violation. That motion was filed in the spring. It was argued in, I believe it was March or April of this year, and right now we're just waiting for a decision from the federal district judge in Brooklyn on that motion. If the motion is granted, then we would have to have a separate trial and discovery on remedy. In other words, what, now that there is a violation that's been proven, what should the city do to, you know, fix the problem, to compensate the victims? So, you know, this case is going to go forward no matter what, even if we win the motion. If we don't win the motion, there's going to have to be a trial on whether or not there was, in fact, a Title VII violation, which means there's going to be a lot of testing experts on both sides coming in to talk about the FDNY's test and whether it was valid or not and whether there are less discriminatory alternatives that could have been used. So I think the short of it is this case is, as Paul alluded to, you know, it is, we think, a settleable case, but if not, then there's going to be a long litigation ahead on this very important issue.
Well, we've got a lot of work to do before we sleep. 400 years of discrimination, and we've got a lot to do to rip it out by its root and change the discourse and change the playing field. And I'd like to thank President John Coombs, president of the Vulcan Society, and past president of the Vulcan Society, Paul Washington, particularly for all the important work that you do that takes the rest of us forward. And my colleague, Darius Cherney, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, it has been a pleasure. And the baby in the background, we're going to make things better for you.
But hopefully before.
Before the baby grows right. up. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to let people know that the College of New Rochelle District Council 37 campus is a four-year college with an outstanding faculty. The vast majority of the College of New Rochelle's graduates go on to graduate school. Many are promoted, advance their careers, and earn salary increases while completing their Bachelor of Arts degree. This unique campus is open only to District Council 37 workers, but workers can take advantage of union educational benefits, tuition stipends, and year-round financial aid to earn their degrees at the District Council 37 campus. It offers a variety of courses and last year launched a concentration in labor studies. If you're a DC 37 member, orientation sessions are held every Monday at 6 p.m. in room 216 at 125 Barclay Street. For additional information, please call 212-815-1710. That's 212-815-1710. A great educational opportunity. And now, UE Local 1174 members and supporters from other unions demonstrated at Wells Fargo's Rock Island, Illinois branch, echoing the slogan of UE members at Republic Windows during their plant occupation. They chanted, "You get bailed out, we got sold out." Nearly a dozen workers were arrested after they blocked a street to symbolize how Wells Fargo is a roadblock to recovery.
Workers are continuing their fight to keep Quad City Die Casting open to save their jobs. The plant is slated to close because Wells Fargo, recipient of $25 billion in federal banking bailout, has cut off operating credit for the company. Now, adding insult to injury, workers fight Wells Fargo to keep jobs and suffer arrests. With Keith Scribner, President Local 1174, United Electrical Workers, UE, and Leah Freed, UE organizer. Welcome
and
to WBA.
Do you want to? You had a little clip you wanted to play.
Yeah, I had a clip of the demonstration last week. Let's play that.
Yeah. Growing protests over the fate of local jobs. Top Show News.
It's the fourth protest against Wells Fargo by union members from QC Diecasting. They're upset the bank won't extend the company's credit to keep the company open and save their jobs.
What most businesses need right now when the economy isn't so good is some credit to get through.
Union members say several parties are looking to bid on QC Diecasting, but a purchase may not happen in time to save their jobs. That's why they're out here again, this time demonstrating that Wells Fargo is acting as a roadblock to recovery. So a group of them went into this busy Rock Island intersection to show that.
Wells Fargo, shame on you!
The small group was arrested, including Joe Osbaker's wife. The couple's from Chicago, and both lost their teaching jobs. They're part of several other unions participating here.
There's millions of people losing their jobs and losing their homes. It calls for more drastic action.
Getting arrested was a small concern when they think about losing what's become their careers.
Why'd you do this? Because I want to save my job!
In Rock Island, Kimberly Brown, 18 News.
Well, I'm getting pretty angry. $25 billion in federal banking bailouts, but the workers get a loss of jobs and arrested. Hey, what's happening?
Hi.
Leah, what's happening? What are you doing about it?
Well, you know, when Wells Fargo decided to no longer provide financing to Quad City Diecasting, and the workers find out that as a result, the company would be closing and over 100 people would lose their jobs. You know, I think the decision was pretty clear that they wanted to fight, and they didn't think it was acceptable, and they're pretty disgusted, too. You know, in this market, it's really hard to find a job, and frankly, they didn't have much of an option. Either they fight to save their job or they face a pretty desperate situation.
Keith, tell us about Quad City Diecasting. What do they make? What's your job, and what are the workers doing?
It's been there for 60 years. It's a aluminum die casting company. It's like a subcontracting company. It makes parts for Kawasaki, John Deere, and Case. And I've been there for about, it's going on 19 years this November. And like I said, it's been open for like 60 years.
How many workers are we talking about, and who are these workers?
Close to 100 people. And what do you mean by who are these people?
What kind of folks work there? Are they local folks? Are they immigrant labor? Is it black? Is it Latino? White working class? Who are the workers?
All
of the above?
All of the above.
I'd say all of the above. Leah's got it right. A few Mexican people, a few Latino people, and white people.
And all of them long-term workers?
We probably got close to, I'd say, 6 to 7 people that's got over 30 years there right now. And I've got one person that's supposed to be retiring in August, and now he's thinking that's not going to happen.
And what do people think's going to happen if the plant closes? What's going to happen to them?
Everybody's just going to spread out their own, go their own way, and start collecting unemployment.
And Leah, this is like the third case in which it isn't the primary villain, the people that you're fighting, maybe I'm wrong in this case, isn't the employer, but it's the banks that we're going after. I mean, there was the Hart Marks situation about 2 weeks ago, and there was, of course, the situation that UE had before that. Tell us what the strategy is and how that's working.
Well, this is an interesting situation at Quad City Diecasting because it's a combination of both the situation that was at Hart Marks, where you have a company that announced it's going to close, and the bank decides to liquidate and pay themselves instead of looking for someone to purchase it and keep it open and keep people employed. And it's similar to Republic Windows and Doors in that the employer was told by the bank in this case, Wells Fargo told Quad City Diecasting they could not pay people their benefits. So they refused to pay vacations, and then on top of that, people aren't getting holiday pay. Their insurance has been canceled, and they've been denied a raise that was supposed to come in June in the contract. And, you know, we need to start taking these banks to task. They took our money. They took our help when they needed it, and now they're essentially preventing economic recovery by throwing people out of work. they can't just say, well, this is our business decision anymore. We need to hold them to more scrutiny, and we need to demand more from them. So here at Quad City Die Casting, workers have been fighting. They've been protesting. They decided to block a road to get arrested because they wanted to show the world that Wells Fargo was a roadblock to economic recovery. And then, you know, I think they're prepared to do whatever they have to do. Right now, the plant is slated to close the end of August. And we've got quite a few elected officials in Illinois who are actively reaching out to the bank to try and get them in dialogue so we can actually get some resolution. But, you know, until then, they're going to keep fighting, right, Keith?
Exactly. Exactly. We're going to fight till the end.
Keith, you had told me this afternoon when I talked to you that the controller of the state government was in yesterday or today?
Today. He was here at 9 o'clock this morning to talk to the people, and then he wanted to take a tour of the plant.
Keith, on top of that, I remember in the Republic Windows and Doors, President Obama even weighed in on that struggle. So aside from the controller, does the community have an understanding of what's being fought for here, how unfair, how wrong it is, that bailout money is being spent, and yet on the ground workers are drowning?
Exactly, exactly. We're not getting the help that we're supposed to be getting. The banks are denying us the financing. And yes, we've got, every time we go and protest in front of a Wells Fargo bank, we get so many supporters. Either they're standing there with us or they're driving by honking their horns in support of, for us.
Leah, is there any chance that the state government or some other entity might withdraw money from Wells Fargo like it was threatened with the Bank of America back in the other struggles?
Well, it's interesting because the elected official you mentioned just a minute ago, his name is Alexi Janulius. He is actually the Illinois State Treasurer. He actually played that exact card during the Hartmarks fight and also during Republic Windows and Doors. He said, you know what, if you're going to act this way to our community, we're not going to do business with you. The state of Illinois is not going to do business with you. And that's an $8 billion threat. So I think that, you know, if it gets to that point, we may be looking at that kind of action on behalf of the government. And I hope they would take that step. But I think what we want to do right now is try and get Wells Fargo into a dialogue so we can at least extend the amount of time so that people can put together. There's several interested parties who are looking to buy the place. It's a company that, you know, it's amazing. Keith has worked there for 19 years. People have been there for a very long time. They make a really high-quality product that's in demand. The reason that, you know, initially they were told the place would close last week, and they had to announce that it would stay open another 6 weeks or so because there's such demand for the product. This is a company that should stay open. It's a business that should be invested in, and Wells Fargo, for whatever nefarious reasons, has made this terrible decision and has made it'll horribly impact the community.
I've got something to add to that.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds, Keith, so
okay,
do it, for sure.
Real quick.
For sure.
Our main customer is Kawasaki, and we have an excellent relationship with them because our parts are so good for them in that, and they're worried. They want to find somehow, some way to keep us open, and they want us to stay open. But the bank won't have any dialogue with us. We can't get the president of the company to dialogue with us. We need somebody to step in and make these guys sit down and talk to us. Somebody.
And that's probably going to be the workers.
That's going to be the workers and their supporters all over the country. We demand that this plant stay open and that the workers continue to do the good work they do. And the next time you're back with us, you're going to tell us exactly how that happened.
We'd love to.
We have complete confidence, always. Thank you so much, Keith Shribner, President, Local 1174, United Electrical Workers, and Leah Fried, Organizer Extraordinaire, also with the UE. And it's been a pleasure. And we want to tell our listeners that we have a good time ahead of us on Thursday, July 23rd, because one of our favorite theoretician activists, Tim Wise, is going to be in town, and he's going to be speaking about institutional racism and the left media, if you will. So we hope you come out to the Community Church at 6:30 on 35th Street and Park Avenue. And you can listen to Tim Wise, that is 35th Street and Park Avenue, the Community Church, on July 23rd at 6:30, and find out a lot more about how we can learn to internalize our own politics. And that's sponsored by Take Back WBAI. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
Have a good evening. Thank you for listening.
Remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.